Blog Talk Radio.
Contradicting yourself here?
No, I'm not contradicting myself. You know, since Sputnik, this is how history is made. Sputnik, what is Sputnik? A little gimmick. You know, the nature of a society is determined by the direction into which energies, ambitions flow. In other words, by the tilt of the social landscape.
Yeah.
Now, up to recently in this country, the tilt was towards business.
Business?
Absolutely. No matter where you started, you wound up as a businessman. Many potential poets and philosophers became businessmen, and as I point out in my book, I think the Promethean nature of American business was due to this fact, you know, that it was built not by conventional businessmen, but by potential philosophers and poets. You know, if you take a potential philosopher and make him a businessman, he acts in a beautiful way. To him, all action is the same. He can be a prize fighter, prize promoter today, he's going to be a manufacturer tomorrow, he's going, business is business. Action is the same thing there.
Puts some kind of soul into it, doesn't he?
Not only this, he will collate and combine factories, mines, railroads, the way that a philosopher generalizes ideas. And so many, you know, the intellectual is becoming a more important person now, more than ever before. Imagine, Henry James tells that he and his brother William in their childhood were ashamed to admit that their father was a philosopher and an author rather than a businessman. And right now the kids on the campus of Berkeley would be ashamed to admit that their father was a businessman and just a grubbing businessman. They would be proud. Or take it the other way. Suppose you lined up 20 years ago, you lined up a businessman, a painter, a poet, a sculptor, a professor, and you got yourself a beautiful girl to pick a husband. Chances are she would have picked the businessman. Right now, don't be so sure. She might even pick the poet, maybe, especially if they got a Guggenheim.
Mr. Hoffer, you seem to have a fear about the rise of intellectuals in political life and power. Why are you so frightened of it?
Well, I'll tell you. First of all, I ought to tell you that I have no no grievance against the intellectual. All that I know about the intellectual is what I read in history, what I saw, how I saw them before, you know, in our time. And I'm convinced that the intellectuals as a type, as a group, see, are more corrupted by power than any other human type. It's disconcerting, Mr. Severi, to realize that power, that businessmen, generals even, I mean soldiers, men of action, are less corrupted by power than intellectuals. And in my new book there, I think I elaborate again, and I give an explanation why. You know, you take a conventional man of action. He starts right if you obey, huh? But not the intellectual. He doesn't want just to obey. He wants you to get down on the knees and praise the one who makes you love what you hate and hate what you love. In other words, whenever the intellectuals are in power, there's soul raping going on.
Is that true in this country? I think it's true in Russia.
Well, in this country, the intellectuals are not in power. See? Now, take the simple thing. People ask me, how about mass movements in this country? And I tell them that mass movements haven't got a chance in this country. For the simple reason that mass movements are not started by the masses. Mass movements are started by intellectuals.
They always are.
Yeah. And in this country, the intellectual has not neither status, nor prestige, nor influence. I mean, we, the common people, are not impressed by the intellectual. You ought to see, not really hated, but a disdain for the pencil pusher. We have seen the pencil pushers working even on the waterfront. And we actually define efficiency by the small number of pencil pushers. You know, how many, if you ask me, what do I call an efficient society? I would say the ratio between the supervisory, between the office personnel and the producing personnel.
The smaller the amount of supervision, the better.
The better, the healthier, the more vigorous the society. And you know, where it's the highest. The highest supervisor personnel is where the intellectuals are in power, in the communist country. There, half of the population is supervising the other half. Now I'm going to ask you a question. Who comes next after the communists? Come on.
After the communists?
Yeah. I bet you know.
I can think of countries like Uruguay that are not communist,
yeah,
where half of them are telling the other.
But
places.
Actually, Britain. Imagine that.
Yeah.
Britain. In other words, wherever the intellectuals are in power, you'll have an enormous population of the supervisory personnel. And why? Because they have a tremendous contempt for the masses. The intellectual cannot operate unless he's convinced that the masses are lazy, incompetent, dishonest, that you have to breathe down their neck, that you have to watch them all the time. And this is where we are sitting pretty, Mr. Severi. Because the masses perform only if you leave them alone, like we. That's where we are at our best.
Yes, but in Britain, a great deal of this pencil-pushing bureaucracy grew right out of the labor movement. People who were laborers.
That's right. And
they
why?
Became worse
they
than the intellectuals.
They have these aristocratic ideas. Everybody in Britain, the moment he gets anywhere, wants to be an aristocrat. Although he says that he's contemptuous of the aristocrats. But there is a worship to class consciousness there that you can get away. Even the communists behave like aristocrats there. Even anybody. Of course, the communists are aristocrats from the word go. But this is our strength. The ability to work without supervision. This tremendous, widely diffused competence. Let me tell you a story. During the Depression, a construction company had to build a road in the San Bernardino Mountains. And the man who was in charge, instead of calling up an employment agency and asking for so many men, he sent down two empty trucks to Skid Row. And anybody who could climb up on that truck was hired, even if he had only one leg. And once the two trucks were full, they put in the tailgate. They drove us out to the San Bernardino Mountains. They dumped us on the side of the hill. The company had only one man on the job, and he didn't even open his mouth. We found their bundles of equipment and supplies. And then we started to sort ourselves out. Mr. Severi, whenever I think of that thing there, it's the most glorious experience I ever had. We had so many carpenters, so many blacksmiths, so many cooks, so many foremen, so many men who could drive a bulldozer, handle a jackhammer, so many cooks. We put up the tent, put up the cook shack, the toilet, the shower bath, cooked supper. Next morning, went out and started to build the road. If we had to write a constitution, there would have been somebody here who knew all the answers and were foreign, and we could have built America. We were just a shovel full of flying scoop off the pavement of Skid Row, yet we could have built America on the side of the hill in the San Bernardino Mountains. Now, you show me anywhere in the world with such a diffuse competence. It's fantastic. In other words, when I talk about the Americans being as skilled people, I don't mean only technical skills. I mean social and political skills. You know, this has been my definition always. The vigor of a society should be gauged by its ability to get along without outstanding leaders. When I said that at the University of Stanford, all the young intellectuals were up in arms. They ran after me after I finished and said, Mr. Hofer, the vigor of a society should be gauged by its ability to produce great leaders. And then I stood there and I said, brother, this is just what happened. Precisely a society that can't get along without leaders is the one that's producing leaders. Look at in the case of Truman. You remember that picture when he was warning? All the great brains standing around and wondering who is being sworn in as a president. Now, the Trumans are a dime a dozen in this country. You can almost close your eyes, reach over the sidewalk, and make a man a president, he'll turn out to be Truman. Show me any society on heaven or on earth that could do like a thing like that. I mean, our potential leaders there are terrific. It's breathtaking.
You mean they're everywhere?
Everywhere.
Now, Mr. Hofer, in Washington, where I work, there's a great deal of talk and controversy about intellectuals in the federal government, the writers that have been in and out of government.
Yeah.
Do you think they contribute anything to governing this country?
Well, I don't know enough, but I know they haven't got the power. The power is in the hand of a Johnson, and Johnson is not an intellectual, although he has been a school teacher. You know, Johnson is one of us, and this is why I have faith in him. See, the intellectuals are important people, I suppose. After all, they produce all our books, paint all our paintings, and all sculpture, and our science. Where would we be without our intellectuals? And I say, give them... pamper them, pet them, give them everything they want, but no power, no power. You see, the problem that faces a modern society is how to canalize the energies of the intellectual and yet not give him power. How to make and keep him a paper tiger. Get it? That's what you have to do. See?
Why do they hate Johnson?
Oh, well, it's just they can't stand the common American. And, of course, look at our American intellectuals, real intellectuals and two-bit intellectuals. Look everywhere in the world, Africa, Asia, Europe. Intellectuals are making history. Intellectuals are statesmen. Intellectuals are even generals. Intellectuals are running things. And here in America, the intellectuals have no power. And so, they're mad. Now, I told you that there's been a change in the tilt of the social landscape right now.
Yeah.
People who should be wheeling and dealing on Wall Street or should be building industrial empires are now throwing their weight around on the campus. They're throwing their way up the academic ladder. They're throwing away their weight around in artistic and literary cliques. And you won't believe it, but making history is a substitute for making $1 million, you know? And the joke is, I'm old enough, you know. At 65, I know the whole cycle. The whole circle, running full. You try to make history at 20, and then when you are 40, you are actually trying, you will be trying to make $1 million on Wall Street. I could tell you instances. You know, on the waterfront, the richest longshoremen are all ex-communists. They're all...
the richest longshoremen.
Absolutely. Actually, from my own experience, I would say that the Communist Party in the United States is a vehicle for transforming true believers into successful real estate dealers. And there is a certain regularity. If you were a Stalinist at 20, chances are you're going to be a real estate dealer at 40. If you are a Trotskyite at 20, you'll probably be a successful professor of sociology at 40, and you'll be sneering at these young, stupid intellectuals. And recently, you know, a few Maoists came to see me, and I had fun with them.
Right. Wait a minute, Maoists?
Yeah, they are worshipping Mao.
China, yeah.
China. And I had real fun with them. I just told them what I told you. I said, I know what the Stalinists are going to be. I know what the Trotskyists are going to be. But what are the Maoists going to be? And I said, let me predict your future. You are going to be laundrymen. You know, there's only one step from brainwashing to laundry washing.
By my time of life, one has accumulated more allegiances and moral debts than the mind can remember or the heart contain. So I cannot enumerate my betters, my mentors, and sustainers during so many years of trying to use with sense this communications instrument as unperfected as the persons who use it. But they know that I know who they are. Many are gone, including the man who invented me, Ed Murrow. Some died in the wars we were reporting. I've gone the normal span of a man's working life, rather abnormal in this calling, and it's a happy surprise. We were like a young band of brothers in those early radio days with Murrow. If my affections are not easily given, neither are they easily withdrawn. I have remained through it all with CBS News, and if it is regarded as old-fashioned to feel loyally to an organization, so be it. Mine has been here an unelected, unlicensed, uncodified office and function. The rules are self-imposed. These were a few. Not to underestimate the intelligence of the audience and not to overestimate its information. To elucidate when one can, more than to advocate. To remember always that the public is only people and people only persons, no two alike. To retain the courage of one's doubts as well as one's convictions in this world of dangerously passionate certainties. To comfort oneself in times of error with the knowledge that the saving grace of the press, print, or broadcast is its self-correcting nature. And to remember that ignorant and biased reporting has its counterpart in ignorant and biased reading and listening. We do not speak into an intellectual or emotional void. One's influence cannot be measured. History provides for the journalist no markers or milestones, but he is allowed to take his memories. And one can understand as he looks back the purpose of the effort and why it must be done. A friend and teacher, the late Walter Lippmann, described the role of the professional reporter and observer of the news in this manner. "We make it our business," he said, "to find out what is going on under the surface and beyond the horizon, to infer, to deduce, to imagine, and to guess what is going on inside, and what this meant yesterday and what it could mean tomorrow. In this way, we do what every sovereign citizen is supposed to do, but has not the time or the interest to do it for himself. This is our job. It is no mean calling, and we have a right to be proud of it and to be glad that it is our work." In the end, of course, it is not one's employers or colleagues that sustain one quite so much as the listening public, when it be so minded. And I have found that it applies only one consistent test, not agreement with one on substance, but the perception of honesty and fair intent. There is in the American people a tough, undiminished instinct for what is fair. Rightly or wrongly, I have the feeling that I have passed that test. I shall wear this like a medal. Millions have listened intently and indifferently, in agreement and in powerful disagreement. Tens of thousands have written their thoughts to me. I will feel always that I stand in their midst. This was Eric Severide in Washington. Thank you and goodbye.
Eric's not retiring from television entirely, but only from daily journalism, and that means, of course, this broadcast. It's not only his beautifully chosen words of wisdom that we shall miss. To this newsman, he's one of the finest essayists of the century. But we shall also miss our almost daily contacts with him in the pursuit of our craft, in which his rare insight and unswerving integrity were a constant source of professional guidance. And yes, it's also true that we shall be the poorer in our self-esteem for no longer being able to call him colleague. But that's the way it is. Wednesday, November 30th, 1977. This is Walter Cronkite, CBS News. Good night.
Hey, Ben, want a hand?
No, you guys go ahead. I got too much on my mind to play poker.
King bets.
Cost you five. Tony, up to you.
Hey, Tony, what are you going to do?
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Me too. Gentlemen, here we are, and one thing is clear. We gotta pick a candidate for Congress this year.
Big ace.
Ace bets.
You'll pay through the nose.
Okay, where do you stand?
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Here goes.
Possible straight, possible flush.
Gentlemen, how about some names we can use? Some qualified Republican who's willing to lose.
How about we should make Jack Riley the guy?
Which Riley are you thinking of, Jack B or Jack Y?
I say neither one. I never even met him.
I say when you got a pair of Jack, bet out.
Politics and poker, shuffle up the cards and find the joke. politics or poker? Which is more important?
Paratrays.
Bet 'em.
Little trays, good as gold.
I'll say. Raise your mind.
I'll call.
I'll hold.
I'll raise your back.
I think you're bluffing.
Put your money where your mouth is.
Okay, I'm in.
Gentlemen, knock it off and let's get this done.
Try Michael Fanyushinkovich. I'm certain he'd run.
Mike is out. I'm afraid he just wouldn't sell. Nobody likes a candidate whose name they can't spell.
How about Dave Zimmerman?
Davey's too bright.
What about Walt Gustafson?
Walt died last night.
How about Frank Monahan?
What about George Gale?
Frank ain't a citizen and George is in jail.